You're listening to Law Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. Lab would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support.
This is Fran reading the Saturday Sun. We're looking now at February 7th already. And I can say no good news on the front page. The middle of the page has a outside view of Northwood Rehabilitation and Healthcare Center. That's at 1010 Varnum Ave in Lowell. It's had some sanitary code problems. This article by Melanie Gilbert. Her email address given is mgilbert@lowellsun.com. That's M-G-I-L-B-E-R-T @lowellsun.com. Dateline Lowell. Northwood Rehabilitation and Healthcare Center was fined $6,000 for what Sanitary Code Enforcement Inspector Matt Sheehan told the Board of Health was an excessive amount of trash at the rear of the facility. The 123-bed facility offers short-term rehabilitation as well as long-term respite and hospice care in Pawtucketville. Sheehan said the anonymous complaint came to the Division of Development Services from a family member of a patient at the center. And he continued, on our initial visit, we instructed them that we would fine them $3,000 if it wasn't taken down the next day. He said this to the board at its Wednesday meeting at City Hall. And he said, he continued here, it was not taken care of and more trash was added. So another fine was added and it was taken care of on the third day, end quote. DDS is under the Department of Planning and Development and conducts health code inspection and enforcement on the city's food establishments and school and reports those findings to the city's Board of Health, which then reports them to the Health and Human Services Department. The Varnum Avenue facility is owned by Athena Healthcare Systems. It's a for-profit Connecticut-based management group established in 1984. It provides healthcare services at dozens of locations in Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island. This particular facility failed its February 2025 city inspection and was cited for numerous violations over a two-month period, including a non-compliant fire suppression system, an unserviced kitchen exhaust hood, which could be a fire hazard, mold, and a four-day sewage backup. And I have to say there's two more pictures here as we go inside the paper. One shows syringe collection program coordinator Andres Gonzalez working at South Common Park, picking up syringes in an area that's right near the STEM Academy, that photo taken this summer of 2025. Then another photo showing members of the Lowell Board of Health, taken also in a photo up at March 5th, 2025. Those people are Chair Joanne Keegan, then Kathleen Cullen-Luter, L-U-T-T-E-R, Aaron Gendron, and Dr. William J. Galvin III. Continuing the article, it says a follow-up inspection in March noted that the ANSUL system, that's the name of it, it's A-N-S-U-L, which is a brand name component that describes kitchen hood fire suppression systems, was still not operational. And there also was no ability to wash linen of all types from March 21st through March 25th due to a sewage backup and line blockage. In previous reporting, Sheehan said that meals at that time were being served in styrofoam containers. He also said the recent trash pile outside the facility was taller than I was. Corporate didn't pay their trash removal company, he said. The Sun then reached out to both management at Northwood and the Athena Company for comment, but received no response. Member Aaron Gendron said that the Board of Health doesn't typically see nursing homes on the failed inspection list. Sheehan said, "They've had their issues. We make it a point to go out to the facility. We'll go around the perimeter because we've had several different issues with them. Some of the patients' relatives do call us and say, 'I saw X, Y, or Z,'" end quote. And following conversation with Director of Health and Human Services Lisa Golden, Sheehan said that the DDS notified the Massachusetts Department of Public Health about this trash issue. He said, "Because every time a major issue comes up, we always call Department of Public Health to let them know what we're dealing with on our end," end of quote. During departmental and divisional reports and updates, Lisa Golden gave a 2025 year-end summary on the city's syringe collection program. That was created back in 2018. And as I've mentioned, the coordinator, Andres Gonzalez, he was hired in 2019. More than 17,000 syringes were removed from Lowell, or the community in general, in 2025, which Ms. Golden said are mostly concentrated around where Narcan is given. But it also includes used needles from a variety of purposes, such as needles used for insulin, immunosuppression, and weight loss medications. Naloxone, commonly known by the brand name Narcan, is an overdose reversal medication that can stop a possibly fatal opioid drug overdose. The total number of syringes collected in the city since 2019 hit 100,000 this 2025. Golden said, "We do have 311 requests along the walking trails, Kerouac Park, and the Riverwalk." She's referring to Lowell's non-emergency service request system. Throwing syringes in a trash or recycling bin, or disposing of them anywhere that's not a safe needle disposal container, is not only against the law, but it also poses a health and a safety risk to the public and the sanitation workers. Sharps disposal kiosks are at Lowell's Health Department. That's at 107 Merrimack Street on the fourth floor. Or you have at the Lowell Senior Center, 276 Broadway Street 1. Another at Lowell Community Health Center, 161 Jackson Street. And the last one at Riverbend, which is 101 Jackson Street on the second floor. To remove a syringe from the community, I guess that means any place in this Lowell area, call the Syringe Collection Program Coordinator at 978-674-1049. Again, 978-674-1049. The Board of Health meets the first Wednesday of every month at 6 p.m. in the Mayor's Reception Room on the second floor of City Hall. Another article from the front page, and quite alarming, actually. This by Grace Zokovitz. She's with the Boston Herald, giving her email address as gzokovitch@bostonherald.com, gzokovitch@bostonherald.com. The state police are warning the public that a lurid artificial intelligence deep fake is not a joke. Their words were, "The Massachusetts State Police is aware of a social media account using artificially generated content to falsely portray a state trooper. We encourage the public to rely on official Massachusetts State Police channels and verified sources for accurate information, and to be cautious of accounts that claim to represent law enforcement without clear verification," end quote. An Instagram account has posted over 50 videos of an AI-generated state police trooper since it began back in early January. The Massachusetts State Police confirmed that the account is, quote, "not affiliated with the department in any way," period, end of quote. The account shows an AI-generated female blonde officer, and the content focuses on sexualized material, and it has over 74,000 followers as of February 5th. Details in the video show some inconsistencies, like changes in the supposed officer's name tag and badge between different posts. The page was reported as a fraudulent account by state police through Instagram's process, but it was still up as of this past Thursday. The state police impersonation comes as AI-generated police and public official scams have drawn attention nationwide, with law enforcement officials warning residents of the rampant ability to impersonate trusted people and organization, to clone voices, and more. The FBI warns that creating synthetic content has been essentially now commoditized and scaled beyond once limited use cases, as tools have gotten easier for a broader customer base across the internet.
You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. Lab would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support.
This is Fran, continuing with the reading of the Sun from February 7th, Saturday. Still on the front page, this again on the audit question, which, as we know, we've been reading about for several weeks and probably one could say months. This is from the State House News Service at the top of the page on February 7th, Dateline Boston, by Sam Drysdale, D-R-Y-S-D-A-L-E. Two courts have rejected audits sought by State Auditor Diana DiSoglio, citing an attorney general opinion and intensifying a stalemate over a bid to audit the legislature. In nearly identical letters, the Executive Office of the Trial Court and the Appeals Court told the Office of the State Auditor they would not participate in website accessibility audits, pointing to a 2023 letter from Attorney General Campbell about how the auditor's authority is limited to executive branch departments, and opening another front in a standoff over the voter-approved law authorizing audits of the legislature. These new denials prompted a sharp response from DiSoglio, who said the court's position departs from decades of precedent and reflects fallout from the Attorney General's refusal to force legislative compliance with the ballot law. The dispute has also deepened a public feud between the auditor and Attorney General Andrea Campbell, with DiSoglio accusing Campbell of enabling broader retreat from transparency. In a November 1st, 2024 letter, Modesta Rosh, that's M-O-D-E-S-T-A-R-O-S-H, director of the auditor's IT audit unit, informed the trial court leadership that OSA would begin a performance audit determining whether the Executive Office of Trial Court websites were accessible in compliance with the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, which are called WCAG, during an audit period of July 1st, 2023 through June 30th, 2024. And a nearly identical letter was sent to the appeals court on the same day. The audit, said Ms. Rush, would be conducted under generally accepted government auditing standards. However, Chief Justice Heidi Breger, B-R-I-E-G-E-R, of the trial court, and Chief Justice Amy Lynn Blake of the appeals court, both declined. In a response signed by General Counsel Daniel Sullivan, the trial court said that the auditor's office may, quote, audit the accounts, programs, activities, and functions directly related to the aforementioned accounts of all departments, offices, commissions, institutions, and activities of the Commonwealth, but, as confirmed by the Attorney General in a November 2nd, 2023 letter to DiSoglio, the word department, in quotes here, in statutes such as these, should in general only encompass executive branch departments, end of quote. The letter from the court continues, Again, we're quoting here, as an independent branch of government, the judicial branch is not under the SAO's purview. That's the State Auditor's Office. The court further argued that the proposed review exceeded matters directly related to the trial court's accounts, and that WCAG standards are not government regulations or otherwise enforceable, and that the court is already complying with the U.S. Department of Justice rule governing website accessibility. Therefore, it said, the trial court hereby respectively declines to comply with the proposed audit, end quote. The appeals court sent a similar denial, and that one was signed by Blake. It quoted the same opinion and concluded pretty much the same, saying, as an independent branch of government, the judicial branch is not under the State Auditor's Office purview, end quote. The appeals court also said that the audit would exceed the auditor's statutory authority and emphasized its ongoing compliance efforts under federal regulation. Ms. Zoglio responded with a lengthy August 6, 2025 letter to court leaders, saying that the refusal marked a new, quote, position for the court and departs from precedent. Our office has audited the judiciary for decades, end quote. Auditor Zoglio said that the office sought only to observe and report on actions taken in the past by administrative staff members in the performance of their administrative duties. She said, I was both surprised and incredibly disappointed to learn of your adamant opposition to a routine audit, which simply sought to shine a light on areas where the court's website could be less bureaucratic and difficult to navigate. This is Mr. Zoglio writing. Even if the court believes it is within its right to refuse such an audit based on the Attorney General's most recent opinion, this completely 180 degree from past practice serves to further erode public trust in the courts, end quote. Citing remarks by Chief Justice Kimberly Budd about declining public confidence in the judiciary, Ms. DeZoglio asked, quoting her now, I ask why now, of all times, would the court decide to stop participating in routine audits? What's the public good that could come out of this position? End quote. And on WGBH News Boston Public Radio, Ms. DeZoglio framed the refusals as unprecedented and tied them directly to the legislative audit fight. She said, this is the first time in the history of the Commonwealth that I just had two justices contact my office and say that due to the Attorney General's position against the legislature being audited, that they don't want to be audited anymore either, end quote. The auditor accused the courts of getting in on the lack of transparency and accountability just at a time when people are distrusting government more. Called it a constitutional crisis and said her trust and faith in the judiciary right now is at an all-time low. The auditor's office told the news service that it audited counts as recently as 2024. They conducted an audit of New Bedford District Court in 24 and the Supreme Judicial Court in 23. The denied appeals and trial court website audits are the only ones that their office has sought to conduct in the courts in the time period since the ballot question which authorized the legislative audit passed. Court spokeswoman Erica Gulli Santiago, that's Gulli-Santiago, said both courts received a request to participate in an audit regarding website accessibility and declined to participate because, by statute, the auditor is empowered to audit the executive branch but not the trials court and the appeals court. She said both courts are actively engaged in complying with applicable website accessibility guidelines, end quote. Ms. Gulli-Santiago did not reply to a follow-up question about past judicial audits and whether court policies change now since the last audit back in 2024. The Attorney General's office also declined to weigh in. Spokeswoman Molly McLynn did not respond to questions about whether the judicial branch must comply with the Office of State Auditor audits, or whether the same logic cited in her 23 letter about the office's authority only over executive branch departments applies to the courts. Former auditor Susan Bump in 2022 audited the land court and the juvenile court, both departments that are within the trial court. Ms. Bump found that the land court did not administer funds held in abandoned escrow accounts in accordance with state law, and did not maintain an accurate publicly available master list of its partition commissioners. The examination of the juvenile court's pretrial diversion program and use of restraints during court proceedings could not be completed because the court lacked data that the Office of State Auditor needed. That report was delivered back to the court with recommendations to improve its data collection and administrative practices. Ms. Bump also audited the appeals court in 2020. That review examined its electronic filing system and showed that the court was improving its processes related to the collection and reconciliation of fees for appellant cases. The latest episodes unfold amid an ongoing impasse over the 2024 ballot law enabling audits of the legislature, which more than 70% of voters did approve. Beacon Hill leaders have questioned the law's constitutionality, and Andre Campbell has not taken the legislature to court to compel compliance. When the news service asked Ms. Campbell this week why her office has strongly enforced the multifamily housing rezoning law we call the MBTA Communities Act, but not the audit law, she repeated her stance that Mrs. Oglio's office has not provided her with all the legal materials that she needs. She said, MBTA Communities Law we've been enforcing since the beginning. Question one, I want to enforce it. I can't because the auditor isn't giving us the information we need. And it's as simple as that. She gives us the information, we'll get it done. End quote. Ms. Campbell also added, we just had a hearing yesterday on the right to repair ballot question. We've been aggressive in our posture and enforcing that. We've not had any issue on any ballot question enforcement or any state agency or constitutional office. The only one we've had issues with is with the auditor, and I think that's telling in many ways. Ms. DiSoglio disputes that account. She has challenged Andrea Campbell to sue her to resolve the matter, accusing the Attorney General of stall tactics. But Campbell has said her office needs clarity from the auditor about the scope of any legislative audit before it can proceed. With the courts now invoking Campbell's thinking to turn away Ms. DiSoglio's audit efforts, the dispute has widened beyond the legislature, leaving unresolved questions about the reach of the auditor's authority. And from the local news page, a quite important decision taken on something that we have read and reported on before, about the battery storage site in Tewksbury. There are two photos here. One shows 73 Hillman Street in Tewksbury and neighborhoods, a glimpse of neighborhoods surrounding it. The picture was taken recently on January 30th. And another, you could say, far away or distance picture or photo of the very same area. So one close up and one quite in a distance, taken of the same general area. Article by Peter Currier. His email, pcurrier@lowellsun.com, pcurrier@lowellsun.com. It says, the select board voted unanimously Wednesday last to approve a host community agreement with Hillman Energy Center, LLC, as the company seeks state approval for a 125-megawatt battery storage facility at 73-75 Hillman Street. The Wednesday meeting took place a week after a joint meeting between the Select Board and the Board of Health to discuss the project. That meeting erupted into arguing between members of both boards and residents during public comment, most of whom that were there were in opposition. Residents were asked to submit any questions they had about the project to the town, and town manager John Curran said Wednesday they had received many such questions, which were posted on the town's website along with the town's responses. Many of those questions surrounded safety concerns nearby residents had about the project and the possible impact on the property values of their homes. Most of the questions, said Curran, were already answered by the contents of the HCA. That is the agreement that is in question here, the so-called host community agreement. Quoting Curran, I know that they're not exactly to the satisfaction of everybody. For example, the property value thing, we did address it, but obviously people would like it if we would pay 100% of their property value. He said this referring to a provision in this HCA for Hillman Energy to maintain a $50,000 fund to compensate homeowners who see property value impacts from the site. As Curran and other town officials have said, the town of Tewksbury has very little say in where this project is or is not approved, as that decision is up to the state's Energy Facilities Siting Board. Select Board Member Patrick Holland asked the town's legal counsel to describe what would happen in a scenario where the board refuses to approve an HCA, again, host community agreement, and the EFSB approves the project anyway, and that is the so-called State Energy Facilities Siting Board. Attorney Jeffrey Bernstein said in that scenario, none of the protective provisions of the HCA would go into effect. Quoting him, none of these are going to be enforceable by the town. This is Bernstein speaking. He added that it would be likely for the EFSB to still impose safety conditions even without an HCA, but the town itself would have no say. He said you would certainly try to work through some of those issues, but you wouldn't have any of the economic consideration. End quote. Board member Eric Ryder, R-Y-D-E-R, said that he has heard the concern over the select board not taking a stance on the project, but echoed other officials in saying that it's largely out of the town's hands. Quoting him, we have already seen two permits in the state right now, in Carver and in Medway, and as Mr. Curran stated, this agreement is much better than both of those. This board has never taken a stance because we had to negotiate in good faith. Without this agreement, we would not be receiving any of these items, end quote. In the event that Hillman Energy relinquishes ownership of the facility, Curran said that the HCA would still apply to any future owners until the project is decommissioned. And he said, but they would still have to decommission it, and there are still guarantees in there for $3 million to $6 million that they would have to commit to pay to restore the site and all those things, end quote. Safety measures in the agreement include a 30,000-gallon dedicated water supply for fire, a requirement of multiple entry points rated for large emergency response vehicles, and an emergency notification system with backup power. It also includes a payment in lieu of taxes agreement, where over a 20-year period, Hillman Energy will pay an annual floor of $2 million plus a 1% Community Preservation Act surcharge, as well as an additional $3.8 million in payments to the town. The host community agreement also covers on-site inspections by fire safety experts, fire safety tests before commissioning, restoration of impacted roads and infrastructure after construction is complete, and noise mitigation. Select Board Member Richard Russo, he thinks the agreement, quote, does a good job with compliance in those laws and those standards, but he questioned what remedies or enforcement would be available to the town in the event of multiple violations of safety or of the agreement by Hillman Energy. Attorney Bernstein said that the EFSB provides a lot of enforcement language in its approval process, and any breaches of obligation of the agreement or the approval would be able to be brought to relevant state agencies to address that violation. He continued, a direct quote, there also is a dispute resolution process under the agreement, so going to court is a last resort unless you need an emergency injunction of some sort, end quote. Responding to another question from Russo about a specific emergency response plan, Curran said the plan would have to be created by Hillman Energy, but the town would actually have some leverage in this area as the plan would need the input and approval of the Tewksbury Fire Department. Quoting Curran, they would be back and forth there on what they wanted in that ERP, and that ERP would be similar to what they have in place for other things. We have assisted living facilities that probably have similar types of emergency response plans, and that's what we mean by ERP. This is the reader reading. So it isn't the fire department's first rodeo, end quote. Select Board Chair Mark Kratman, K-R-A-T-M-A-N, said he wished the proposal could be decided locally, especially ideally in a town meeting. He said, I think people would feel like their voices were heard much better in the community. But with the HCA approved by the board, the town had to submit discovery by Friday. After that, the siting committee, or the siting board, will conduct evidentiary hearings, while briefs and replies from all intervening parties will be submitted afterwards. The process is expected to extend at least through this spring. Speaking just before the vote to approve the agreement, Select Board Member James Mackey, M-A-C-K-E-Y, said he wants to see the board be a little more engaged with residents so we don't let the fear, uncertainty, and doubt continue to grow, as it did with this project.
Thanks for listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to Lab Radio. Request a free specialized receiver, or for more information about our radio reading service, call Lab at 978-454-5704. You can listen to Lab Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069 or visit our website where you can tune into Lab Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. Thanks for listening.